from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum in our next hour, we'll talk with Pulitzer Prize-winning author, journalist, and playwright Lawrence Wright. His new play on the life of Italian journalist Oriana Fallaci premieres at the Berkeley Repertory Theater this week. Fallaci died in 2006. She was well known for her controversial and fiery interviewing style. She once threw her chador off in protest while speaking with Iran's Ayatollah Khomeini. And Lawrence Wright himself is no stranger to controversy. His latest book, Going Clear, is an in-depth investigation into Scientology and its ties to Hollywood. We'll talk about the fallout from the book and discuss how Fallaci influenced Wright's own journalistic work. That's all up ahead on this morning's Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of the Forum program. Former contributing editor to Rolling Stone, Lawrence Wright for many years now has been a staff writer for The New Yorker, actually since 1992, and he's co-author of a film called The Siege, which you may recall, starring Denzel Washington, Bruce Willis, and Annette Bening, and wrote the script for the Showtime movie Noriega, which starred Bob Hoskins. He's also the author of The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11, which won the Pulitzer Prize, and the recently published book about Scientology, Going Clear, Scientology, Hollywood, and the Prison of Belief. He's a recipient of the John Barlow Martin Award for Public Interest Magazine Journalism and the Overseas Press Club and Ed Cunningham Award for Best Magazine Reporting. And he also authored a new play based on the life of Italian journalist Oriana Fallaci, which opens its world premiere at the Berkeley Repertory Theater on the 13th of March. Joins us for this Forum Hour. Good to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you, Michael. It's good to be on your show.
Didn't even mention the fact that you're also a blues a keyboard player in a blues band in Austin, Texas. This is a pretty extraordinary versatility that you have. Let's talk about the Fallaci play first, though, because it's the 65th world premiere here at our own Berkeley Repertory Theater, and you had another one-man play, I know, on my trip to Al-Qaeda.
Yeah.
Kind of balancing this between, you know, author and reporter and journalist and playwright, tough balance, I imagine.
I think all of these things reinforce each other. And, you know, I've learned a lot in writing my nonfiction from my experience in working in the theater and working in movies, especially about the importance of scenes and characters. Because, you know, no matter what kind of writing you're doing, those are the elements that really get the reader engaged. And I bring to these other projects my process, my reporting process, which is to deeply sink into the material and report it out. And I also use note cards just like a graduate student in the 1960s. But I do a lot of research. I find that it helps me when I know what is real in a story. It helps me write it, whether it's fiction or nonfiction.
Although one's dramatic and the other's repertorial narrative, so you would think, and yet for you, it's synthesized, it sounds like, which is terrific. Certainly no dearth of material when it comes to Oriana Fallaci. This is a woman who was about to go on trial before she died in Italy for vilifying Muslims, saying Muslims breed like rats and all that. A woman who actually made Ayatollah Khomeini laugh. I mean, but she's known particularly for her fierceness and her fiery passion, you know, in doing these interviews that she did with all Khomeini and Castro and Gaddafi, Kissinger. She was fearless, wasn't she?
She was. And what was fascinating to me, she came on before the women's movement really got started. And here was this tiny Italian woman who would bring world leaders to heel, absolutely intimidate them. And she seemed to be able to plumb the depths of a person's soul. She had mastered the art of the interview in a way that I could never really imitate. But she made journalism sexy, important, exciting, and it really awakened me as a young man to the possibility of making that as a career.
So you discovered her how?
I think... you know, first of all, she came to everybody's attention because, you know, if you were a world leader, one of the signals of your accomplishment was that Oriana Fallaci took notice of you and decided it was worth interviewing you.
She was the world leaders and tyrants, sort of what Barbara Walters is to gossipy Hollywood.
Yeah, exactly.
But when I say I didn't mean to actually discover her. I mean, when did she make, or what was it that made the impact on your imagination or your desire to be a journalist?
I will never forget her interview with Ayatollah Khomeini, which in some ways was one of the greatest interviews ever done. And it's a feature in the play, but, you know, here was, she was the first Westerner to speak to him. And here was this glowering theocrat, you know, that was so intimidating. And she went into it with a strategy. She had decided, you know, that he hated women and that she was a Western woman. How would she talk to him? And she decided that she would adopt the tone of the one woman that he respected and feared and admired, and that was his mother. So she talked to him in this very stern, maternal way. And at some point, she was asking him about the chador, the Islamic garb, the headgear that in Iran all women are required to wear. And he made some comment about it. It's our tradition. It's not a Western tradition. And she said, well, very well then, I'll take off this stupid medieval rag. And she ripped off her chador and, you know, bareheaded, stared at him. And then he jumped up and ran out of the room. And she said later, she said in the voice of his mother, where do you go to make pee-pee? And I'm like, wait a minute, how can you talk to the Ayatollah Khomeini like that? And she refused to move unless he agreed to resume the interview, which he did. Well, hats off to her. I mean, after that, I was completely...
Shader's off. I would have said Shader.
Shader's off.
Shader's off. I mean, and did you think about this when you were interviewing Ayatollah Khomeini? When you were interviewing Osama bin Laden?
Well, I never actually talked to Osama bin Laden. I talked to a lot of people in al-Qaeda and in the jihadi community.
But you took the same attitude?
No.
Were you going to be their dad? Or?
You know, actually, after 9/11, it was an awkward period. I spent a lot of time in Egypt and Saudi Arabia and Pakistan. And you know, I was a little... Normally, I'm very neutral and impartial in my interviews. I have a kind of studied approach about that. But I was angry. And sometimes the anti-Americanism and the conspiracy thinking and so on would just really upset me. And I wasn't always as fully in control as I like to think that I am. So there were moments where there were really angry exchanges. I remember after 3 months in Egypt, where I used to live when I was a young man, I had so many fingers wagged under my nose about America. I thought the next time that happens, I'm going to snap it off, you know. But I had my last day in Cairo, I had an interview with the chief spokesperson for the Muslim Brotherhood, who had just gotten out of prison for the umpteenth time. And he was angry, and I was angry, and we just had the most upsetting, you know, yelling match at each other. And the funny thing is, the next time I saw him, next time I went back, we had a very civil conversation. But, you know, sometimes, you know, your instincts as a reporter get put aside by your very personal feelings.
Well, you must have had personal feelings about David Miscavige when going into the Scientology book.
Well, I feel that Scientology, you know, I've always been interested in why people believe in different religions, especially in America, where you can believe anything. It's not true in a lot of countries. You know, you can believe one thing more or less, but here, you know, fascinating panoply of religions.
I should mention that David Miscavige is the head of Scientology.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. And... yeah, I tried to talk to him when I was writing my book, and the Church of Scientology would not let me do so. I've had 12 people tell me that they've been beaten by David Miscavige, and more than 20 who've witnessed such assaults. So I would like to have the opportunity to ask him about those allegations, but he's denied the opportunity.
And the Church of Scientology is kind of locked down. They used to importune us to come on the air and particularly inveigh against psychiatry because they've kept this campaign going and really a crusade for a long time against psychiatry. And now they're invited and they don't come. They simply refuse to be interviewed, as Miscavige did with you. But you did talk to a lot of people, a lot of Well, and the church, there's been blowback. I mean, the church has said, you know, the book is full of errors and lies and all the rest of that sort of thing. In fact, it's been banned in Canada.
The UK is, you know, the Church of Scientology threatened my British publisher, and because of the British libel laws, the publisher folded his tent. I was over in the UK a couple of weeks ago talking to members of Parliament who are trying to change these notorious libel laws in Britain. You know, people come from all over the world to sue in Britain because of the libel laws. They're so much in favor of people who feel that they've been wrongly quoted or mistreated in the press. And the burden is on the defendant. Unlike here, where we have a First Amendment and you have the opportunity for free speech, it's very circumscribed in the UK.
That's why David Irving brought a lawsuit, for example, the Holocaust denier in England, because of the libel laws there. But what's the furor about here? I mean, what are we talking about? They've called you an atheist. They said you're bigoted. I mean, the Church of Scientology has come back.
Right.
Are you facing the possibility of lawsuits? Are you facing threats? That's been a pattern with them.
Well, certainly facing threats. I mean, from the very beginning, the church has a reputation for being litigious and vindictive towards its critics and defectors and reporters. And previous reporters have had the experience of being hounded by private investigators, framed for crimes that they didn't commit. I had my eyes open about what might happen, but so far it's all been threats and nothing more than that.
So what's in the book? I mean, you particularly focus on Miscavige and on L. Ron Hubbard, the founder of Dianetics,
right,
which became the essential underlying philosophy and religion that Scientology was to become. These are two major and heroic figures of great power, both past and present, but I guess really, now I'm guessing here, that that most of the anger and most of the blowback has been from exposure of things like abuse.
Yeah. Those are the kinds of things they're trying to keep me from revealing. And, they've sent out a number of disclaimers to different programs that I've been on, saying things such as, I mentioned in the book about Operation Snow White, which was a massive Scientology infiltration of the American government and other governments. They infiltrated the FBI, the Justice Department, Food and Drug Administration, the Washington Post, the American Mental Health Association, and German government, other governments as well. More than 5,000 Scientologists deployed to do this.
Particularly angry, I remember, Germany, because they wouldn't allow them to be a religion.
Yeah. Well, one of the statements by the church was that no laws were broken. 11 people went to prison for it, including the wife of the founder, Mary Sue Hubbard. So I sometimes look at the statements that the church puts out, and I wonder what history they're reading.
Well, you also exposed secret camps. There was a place called Gold Base that had a hole that you write about. The hole was a place where – and people were working for, 50 cents an hour and doing essentially kind of slave labor?
There's a clergy inside Scientology. It's called the Sea Org, or Sea Organization. And people often join this as children. They're pressured into signing billion-year contracts, and they work for $50 a week, and essentially they surrender their education, and they work, really long hours. And it's on that base in Southern California in the desert where the Sea Org has its international headquarters. And there's a pair of double-wide trailers that are married together that had been in an office suite. And in 2006, David Miscavige cleaned out all the furniture and began sending his top-tier executives into what they called the hole to sleep on the floor and spend the day trying to confess their crimes to each other. At one point, more than 100 people were locked up in the hole, and some of these people had been there for months and years. The nominal president of the church is an elderly man named Heber Jentsch, who was in the hole for 7 years. I think, these kinds of behaviors on the part of the church are are really something that the church has to answer for.
Well, when there was talk about liberating these people in the hole, essentially some of these folks who had been involved in Scientology said if there were to be an FBI raid, they would say there's nothing being done to us.
That's right. They would be there for their – they're only there for their own good. You know, one night in the hole – this is a story I think that tells a lot about the mindset inside Scientology. The leader of the church, Miscavige, came into the hole with a jam box, and he said, "We're going to play musical chairs." And he brought chairs in, you know, and had all these executives play the game. The tune he was using was Queen's Bohemian Rhapsody. And he said, "The last person to sit will stay, but everybody else is going to be shipped off or thrown out of the Sea Org. Husbands and wives are going to be separated." He actually had airline tickets printed up by the travel office in Scientology to give reality to this. And this went on for hours and hours till early in the morning. As the number of chairs was reduced, people began, fist fights broke out, clothes were torn, chairs were broken. And what was so striking to me is that they were fighting to stay in the hole. And that's why one of the subtitles of the book, Going Clear, is The Prison of Belief. Because I realized that it wasn't exactly that most people are being held against their will. It was their will that was holding them there.
Talking with Lawrence Wright, who is the author of Going Clear, and it's an in-depth investigation of Scientology. And these are people who believe in Xenu and the Galactic Confederacy from 75 million years ago and Thetans having to be expelled by auditing. I mean, you know, a lot of religions sound pretty strange to people.
Yeah.
And if you are an atheist, as the scientists, Scientology has accused you of being, as if there's an accusation with that, then you have to realize, I suppose, all religions have some pretty far out ideas, especially from an atheist point of view. But these seem like really far out.
Well, esoteric beliefs are, you know, common in different religious communities. And I don't know, atheist, I probably agnostic would be a better way of describing my religious stance. I used to be very religious as a teenager. But as a reporter, I've spent much of my career examining religious beliefs. From my first book was about the Amish, and I've written about Baptists and radical Islam and Mormons. You know, I've examined a number of different religions, and I've come to appreciate the power of religious belief for good or ill in shaping personalities and societies. I think religion is much more profound in its effects than political beliefs, for instance, which one can have passively. But if you are a believer in a powerful religious belief, it will probably shape your behavior. And that's interesting to me as a reporter. And I think it's something that we tend not to pay a lot of attention to. It's, you know, religion has no status in the journalism world. And yet it's fascinating to me how much of our lives, if you just open the paper every day and look at the front page, how much of it is propelled by, you know, clashing religious ideas.
And how many of those religious beliefs are led often by, well, in the case of David Miscavige, somebody who you pretty much present to us, as you just did in the story with the chairs, as being perhaps sadistic or certainly authoritarian, tyrannical. And Tom Cruise and he are, shall we say, almost like Siamese twins. I mean, they have been very close and they have supported each other, and he's a mentor to Cruise and has gone out of his way for Cruise. And in this sense, you find that a lot of what Scientology has to answer for becomes Cruise becomes a complicitous figure, let me put it that way.
I think that Tom Cruise and other celebrity pitchmen for Scientology have something to answer for, because they've been exploited by the church. Their membership has been used to advertise Scientology, especially to the entertainment industry. And many, many people have been drawn into Scientology, no doubt, because of the example of John Travolta, Kirstie Alley, Tom Cruise, and others.
This was L. Ron Hubbard's idea from the beginning, wasn't it?
Yeah. Early on, he set up he established the Church of Scientology in Los Angeles in 1954, and then created the Celebrity Center in Hollywood. And the idea was to take over the entertainment industry. They published a roster of possible Scientology recruits. They included Bob Hope, Walt Disney, Marlene Dietrich, Howard Hughes, some of the most famous people in the world, And the idea was that such an exemplary figure would give credit to the church. And also, I think Hubbard realized that celebrity itself is something that Americans worship, and not just Americans, the whole world. But if you have a church that's built to attract celebrities, then you'll draw other people to the flag as well.
How did it do that? I mean, attract so many celebrities. I know they went out, in a dogged way after them. Like you said, there was a list, sort of like talk about a blacklist like Nixon. There should be a white list of potential Scientologists, but they succeeded in getting so many.
Let's take the example of John Travolta, who was a young actor in his first movie, and he was having some personal problems. An actress on the set gave him a copy of Dianetics, which was Hubbard's self-help therapy book that he published in 1950. And then she did some auditing, which is Scientology therapy on Travolta. And he had the experience that many people have. He had an out-of-body experience. He went exterior in Scientology lingo. And that's very profound for a lot of people. The sense that Scientology inculcates in you is that you are a thetan. You are an immortal being. You're not your body. You're not your mind. You are a spirit that's separate from that. And if you have a past life memory, or if you have the experience of leaving your body, as he apparently did, then that comes as significant proof that that's true. He went back to Los Angeles and began taking courses at the Celebrity Center. And he told the teacher one day that he was trying out for a role on Welcome Back, Kotter. So she had the whole class orient themselves towards ABC Studios and telepathically send the message, John Travolta is right for this role.
So that's how he got that role.
He got the role, and he always felt that Scientology, as he said, put him in the big time.
Talking with Lawrence Wright, his book is Going Clear, and his play on Arianna Fallaci will open at the Berklee Repertory Theater. And its world premiere on March 13th, actually the stigma now in Hollywood is much stronger because of work of like yours and other work before, but also the membership total is bleeding. It's not what it was.
We don't know. Of course, Scientology doesn't release real membership figures. They say they have 8 to 10 million members, and if according to poll data, only 25,000 Americans identify themselves as Scientologists, and the number of people who are members of the International Association of Scientologists, which may be the best indicator of how many real Scientologists there are in the world, is about 30,000. So the range is somewhere between 30,000 and 10 million. I tend to think that it's much larger than 30,000 because the number of people that I've run into whose lives have been touched or damaged because of families being torn apart is so profound.
Well, there's even an independent former Scientology organization that has tried to take the beliefs, I guess. And, well, we'll come back and talk more with Lawrence Wright. We're coming up on a break here. You hear our music. Let me tell you how you can join us. Toll free now, 866-733-6786, or email us at forum@kqed.org. We want to hear from you. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending the hour with Pulitzer Prize-winning author, journalist, and playwright Lawrence Wright. His new play on the life of Italian journalist Arianna Fallaci will premiere at the Berklee Repertory Theater next week. She died in 2006 and was certainly well-known, to put it mildly, for her controversial interviewing style. But he also has a book out called Going Clear, and it's an in-depth investigation into Scientology and its ties to Hollywood. And we're talking about the book and the fallout from the book, and you are certainly welcome to join us. In fact, if you have some thoughts about Scientology, or particularly if you've had some experience, and I know there are lots of people out here in the Bay Area particularly who have had, you may want to weigh in on this conversation and give us your own impressions, thoughts, or for that matter, emotions. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786, and you can join us now at that number, 866-733-6786. Other ways to join us, email us, forum at kqed.org. Go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment. Or you can also go to our Facebook page, or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is at kqedforum. And here's an online comment, actually about about Falaci. I always wanted to read her biography of Panagoulos, but her anti-Islamic statements made me wary of her journalistic objectivity.
Yeah, you know, that I completely agree with that, because when I was young, I was so admiring of her and, you know, her courage, her, you know, her incisiveness. And then after 9/11, she wrote these anti-Muslim screeds, which are very powerful. I mean, the thing about Oriana Fallaci is her rhetoric is just incredibly potent. And a lot of the anti-Muslim movement, especially in Europe, has been, you know, inculcated by her language. And her language that has really formed these groups. And this, of course, happened to be something that I knew a lot about. I was in the middle of working on my own book about 9/11, The Looming Tower. And I realized her limitations in a way that I hadn't before. So when I started writing this play, it's a way of having me examine. I'm having a conversation with her in some ways through the means of this play, because I'm trying to balance my admiration with my loathing. And she invites such controversy.
She aroused strong emotions.
Yes, she did.
And posthumously still arouses, obviously.
She does. She's a...
gave you a creative springboard.
Formidable figure.
Here's Nick, who says, big thanks to your guest for being brave enough to report on Scientology. Years ago, a company I worked for got bullied by them to the point that they had a red phone installed in tech support, and the instructions we got were, if that phone rings, answer it and do whatever they ask. I did a little research on them, and what I found scared me. Now, you go into the book about how they essentially established themselves as a religion, and mm-hmm. that has a lot to do with, I suppose, similar tactics. I mean, what, there were some 2,400 lawsuits, and they had private investigators going out just so they could be a religion, so at least according to most lights, they could be tax exempt.
Well, this, what you're referring to is 1993, when the church had years before decided not to pay taxes. And by 1993, it was $1 billion in arrears, and it didn't have $1 billion. They had to have a tax exemption. This was, you know, or otherwise it would be out of business. So David Miscavige, leader of the church, launched these 2,300 lawsuits against the church, against the IRS, and individual agents, hired private investigators to follow agents around, see who was drinking too much or having sex on the road or whatever. And part of the deal that the IRS worked, I mean, they really crippled the IRS, but part of the deal was that those lawsuits would be dropped, the private investigators would be called off, the $1 billion would be forgiven, and the Church of Scientology would be recognized as a religious community and afforded all the protection, religious guarantees of the First Amendment, which were really considerable. And it's that, as much as the tax exemption, that protects the Church of Scientology.
So the IRS caved, basically, and people think the IRS, they usually don't think of it caving.
Well, whatever the merits of the case they were considering, and I think, you know, the IRS is very poorly equipped to make such distinctions about religion or sex or cults, but they are the one agency entitled to make that distinction. And once they came to that conclusion, the Church of Scientology's future was secured.
How do they get to establish this extraordinary, staggering amount of real estate holdings and wealth. I mean, you know, it's in fact, what are we talking about now, estimated wealth of the Church of Scientology?
More than $1 billion in liquid assets, not just talking about property. I'm talking about offshore money and accounts and, you know, Liechtenstein and places like that. A lot of money. And the Catholic Church would have a hard time coming up with $1 billion in cash right now. So it's extraordinary, given the diminished size of the membership of the Church of Scientology. What they have is a lot of money and a lot of lawyers. But they are really, I think, facing mass defections. And certainly the number of people that I've talked to that have left the church has been, you know, quite extraordinary. And it seems to be a river of people leaving right now.
Let me bring our – well, of course, you talked to Paul Higgins, a filmmaker, and he – one of those big name, I suppose, ex-Scientologists, but many of them have stayed with a lot of the belief. They believe in Hubbard's philosophy and theology, if you want to call it that, and I suppose it's ripe to be called that. They're independent Scientologists now who have divorced themselves from the church.
Yeah, in fact, this is a growing movement. And, you know, people who've been in the church, who've grown up inside the thinking that is Scientology, oftentimes have a hard time walking away from it. And I'm not saying that they don't get something out of it. I think that a lot of people do feel that they've been rewarded by Scientology. And every religion has something to offer, I suppose, or it wouldn't have any adherence at all. But once you're outside of the church, for a lot of people, it's very difficult to accommodate to the non-Scientology world, the WOG world, as it's known in Scientology. Because people don't speak the same language that you do. They ridicule your beliefs, and there's a way, there's an approach to human behavior that is Scientology that you know, non-Scientologists find very puzzling. But a lot of Scientologists rely on it, and I'm fascinated that people can hang on to those beliefs once they get outside the structure.
Talking with Pulitzer Prize-winning author, actually won the Pulitzer Prize for The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11, Lawrence Wright, also staff writer for The New Yorker and author of Going Clear, Scientology, Hollywood, and the Prison of Belief. And once again, his play, Falaci, is based on the life of Italian journalist Oriana Falaci, and it opens at the Berkeley Repertory Theater March 13th. And he'll be talking about the book Going Clear, which he's talking about with us mostly this hour, with Mark Danner tonight, March 4th at 7 p.m. at the Berkeley Repertory Theater. And we'll go to your calls, and we begin with Bob from up in Healdsburg. Bob, you're on.
Good morning, Mr. Krasny. Good morning to your guests.
Morning.
I was recruited by the Church of Scientology as an outside contractor to help them establish a situation at their Celebrity Center to help recruit outside guests, particularly those that you're talking about, celebrity types. And I've personally witnessed many of the things that your guest is talking about this evening. And it was very interesting to be there on a daily basis to see these occurrences. I was not the only person that had been recruited at that point or hired as an outside independent help. There was a couple of us there. And when I was hired, I had to literally sign a $1 billion with a B contract as non-disclosure so that I would not talk or reveal any of the things that I witnessed and saw within the Celebrity Center. I found that a lot of the people that I talked to that were members of the Sea Org there came from a military background or a broken family background. They were searching for some type of structure in their life. They needed the rules and the and people that told them what to do on a daily basis, found them to be, their life to be very disjointed because at any moment they could be sent off to any part of the world to do whatever work was required by the church or asked of them to do. I found them in constant fear and panic of the idea that somebody like Miscavige would show up at any day, mysteriously or unannounced. And when it was supposed that he was announcing, boy, you would believe what would go on inside the Celebrity Center at the anticipation of his secret arrival at any given moment.
You haven't just violated your billion-year contract, have you?
I realize. So that's why my name is not really Bob. the other thing is that I would witness punishment given out to people, you know, who weren't meeting their quota on a daily basis, members of the Sea Org. One day it would be an executive, the next day it would be down in the very bowels of the basement mopping the floor up. And, you know, if I had the answer to them for a certain decision-making, then they wouldn't be around, and all of a sudden I'd be passed on to somebody else. I found a lot of the people that were struggling to take these classes and take advantage of the classes, which I did see help for a lot of people in these classes, could not afford to take these classes. This is the one thing they don't, I think, disclose to a lot of the people who join the Church of Scientology, that these are very expensive classes to take, and it's a very long, drawn-out process.
And I thank you so much for offering those impressions and memories to us, Bob, and appreciate your call. Actually, Lawrence Wright, it's not only expensive classes, but didn't many people early on in the history of the Church, I don't know if this is still true, sign over inheritances and to the Church of Scientology?
Well, the Church is relentless in gaining access to, you know, contributions, and has so many people just, you know, to climb the ladder of spiritual accomplishment in the Church to get to the top. It might cost you as much as $500,000. And then there's the therapy, which is called auditing, which is also very expensive. And then you're expected to buy the works of L. Ron Hubbard. He published more than 1,000 books. So
why was he prolific? And you point out also a prevaricator, I mean, about his narrative in the war.
Yes, he's a fascinating individual. I was really fortunate to have the chance to write about him. But there are two narratives about Hubbard's life. And just to take the example of after World War II, he was in this naval hospital out here in Oakland. And he claimed that while he was there that he had been blinded and crippled by his heroic war service, and that the medicine couldn't help him, but he healed himself using these techniques he developed into Dianetics. And I got his medical records and his war record, and he had a completely undistinguished experience in the war, in the Navy, and he had conjunctivitis and ulcers. He was, these were not profound injuries. But if the theory, you know, the story of the Church, the legend is that he healed himself, he created Dianetics, and then he set out to heal the world.
And that's where become well-healed, to put it mildly.
Yes, he did become well-healed. Good point.
Bring in some more of our callers. Anne from Novato. Good morning.
Yes, hi. I was wondering if the author talked to some mainstream people, Scientologists, who were happy with it and it worked for them. Because sometimes I think when people leave, they were on the fringe anyhow and didn't find what they were looking for. So I just wondered, you know, and it's like kind of like someone writing about the Catholic Church. They're writing about Opus Dei, and they think, oh, that's the mainstream thing, where most people, Catholics, oh, Opus Dei, that's a really fringe group. So I just wondered, did he talk to people that were happy with Scientology? That's my question.
Yes, I did. At the beginning, the Church was more open to me. I was writing about Paul Haggis, who was a former member of the Church who dropped out. And the Church was not happy that I was writing about Scientology through the eyes of an apostate, as they called him. But at the beginning, they were willing to let me speak to other Scientologists who were still in the Church. And I did certainly speak to people who had good experiences. They were sort of hand-picked by the Church. But and I continued to have conversations with the spokespersons.
So when did they
Church.
Stop access for you?
I was told by Tommy Davis, who was the chief spokesperson for the Church at the time, that he was going to take me through Scientology. This was in 2010 when I had begun my research. And he wanted to have me allow enough time. So I said, he set up the Memorial Day weekend. And I went out and I spent Friday night, Saturday night waiting for him. Finally, on Sunday afternoon, he came out and said that he was not going to talk to me. He was not going to take me through Scientology as he had promised. But he said he just wanted to have the opportunity to tell me that face-to-face, which I could not help but feel that it could have been done over the phone. But he did agree to respond to fact-checking queries. And I don't know if he understood what that meant in the New Yorker context, because fact-checking is something that we take very seriously. And the first volley of our queries was 971 questions. And that elicited a trip to New York, to the New Yorker offices, by Tommy Davis and his assistant and four Scientology lawyers, where we spent the entire day going through all this material. And they brought along with them 47 white binders of material, which stretched out for 7 linear feet. And I can't tell you, Michael, the joy with which I regarded this, because I looked at that and I saw I had a book here.
And we have more callers. We go to Donald. Good morning.
Good morning. And I'm going to be reading your book, sir. Your explanations are some of the best I've ever heard. I was involved. You got to excuse my voice this morning. I was involved in Scientology for 8 years, from the mid-70s through the early 80s. And, my emphasis was learning the religious technology, the auditing, becoming an auditor and helping people. And it's interesting that the people that learned the science part, the scientific part of Scientology, the technology, they looked at the organization and the insanity of it and tried to ignore it and not get involved in what Hubbard had, put together based on his paranoia of feeling like he was being attacked by every country in the world, similar to the parody in this new film, The Master, that's out, which is a brilliant film. But honestly, my own experience as being audited myself, or they call it co-auditing, the word audit means to look into, as you know. I have achieved spiritual states that, are with me today, and I've gone on to study other religions of the world and to study philosophy. So this is something that's happened with a lot of ex-Scientologists, is that they will move on, get over the terminologies and the lingo that keep you cult bound and keep you alienated from the real world. And then, it took me a few months to realize that this so-called WOG, which comes from England, it means worthy Oriental gentleman. People are not worthy Oriental gentlemen. People are people. Some of them have more problems or less problems than others. And some of them don't have. Some people are naturally, inherently, spiritually, and beautiful people, most of the people on Earth. So, a lot of ex-Scientologists had a very good experience, as you mentioned, with the technology, and not so much trying to deal with the insanity of his organization and the paranoia.
Donald, by the technology, you mean the auditing and that whole process that you went through, don't you? Yeah, okay. Of course, Lawrence Wright, comment?
One of the things that I was thinking about while Donald was talking...
Thanks, Donald.
...is that Scientology doesn't really see itself or pitch itself as a faith, which one of the contradictions about it being a religion, but it says that it is a technology, and it's guaranteed as you go from one level to another to, reach this level of spiritual enlightenment. And when people get into the church at the beginning, and one of the things that attracted Paul Haggis, the 2-time Academy Award winner that I write about, is, one of Hubbard's statements is, if it's not true for you, it's not true. In other words, you have the discretion.
It sounds like solipsism almost.
Exactly. And if you feel like, the whole idea is that it's always something that you're filtering through and you have this autonomy. And yet what's so characteristic of Scientology is it turns into this totalistic universe where you're not thinking for yourself. And instead of gaining additional autonomy, you're surrendering your will to the church. And that's the paradox I find so striking. This is, a very controlling organization, not just of the members of the Sea Org, but, ordinary public members of Scientology who are instructed not to listen to outside criticism.
Don't
look at
that. It's the idea of obedience, too, isn't it, really? I mean, underlying all of that. Our truth is the truth, I mean, in that sense. And actually, you're talking about Scientology not being a faith, and one of our listeners, Beth, asks, the Scientology buildings have a Christian cross on the top, yet they are anything but Christian in any of their beliefs. Why the cross? It was just a symbol that I guess they took. It's not really a Christian cross. It's sort of an embroidered cross.
Well, it's a cross with an X in the side of it, in the middle of it. And it's there was during the campaign to gain tax exemption, the church underwent one of the former members who was a lawyer in the church called religious cloaking, wearing ministerial collars, for instance, and adopting the cross, having services, and so on. Those things were not so characteristic of the Church of Scientology in the early days. But as they approached the need to become recognized as a religious community, they took on more of this decor.
Another listener named Hal asks, where exactly is Scientology's 500-acre desert base?
It's in Southern California near a town called Hemet. It's very remote, and I've spoken to a number of people who have actually had to escape, and many of them were brought back and put into these re-education camps for months and years at a time.
Wow. Sounds like Mao's China or Cambodia, especially when you talk about re-education camps.
You know, I talked to Robert J. Lifton, who
famous psychiatrist,
yes, and he did a lot of the early work on what he calls mind reform. He doesn't use the term brainwashing, but he was looking at during the Korean War, where many American and NATO troops were picked up and or UN troops were taken into China, and some of them came out espousing communist doctrine, and this was quite shocking to Americans at the time. That's where the term brainwashing first emerged. But Lifton looked at the examples of the number of people who were placed in these conditions, what he called totalistic universes. And it does resemble, in some respects, the situation that pertains inside the Sea Org.
We go to more of your calls. We go next to you, Peter. Thanks for waiting. You're on.
Hi. I just wanted to relate an experience with Scientology. I was a student in 1978 at the Berklee College of Music in Boston. You may know that's a jazz school.
Yes, indeed.
There were
you're talking to a keyboard player here.
Yeah.
People, Chick Corea, one of my idols, was one of the people who was then and probably still is involved with Scientology, and that was touted pretty highly at that school. And they used to hang out on the street corners all over Boylston and Mass Ave in Boston and recruit people there. And one of my friends was recruited and didn't have, like many musicians, didn't have enough money to pay for it. So they got him to sell the Dianetics books. And, he had a whole pyramid of them in his room and was always struggling, spending most of his time trying to sell these things to people. But anyway, they used to recruit people to take their free personality tests. And I was kind of going through an anti-authoritarian phase there. There was like EST and actualizations and Scientology all over. And I kind of wanted to rebuff them all at the time. So I decided to take the test, and they took me down to this building in downtown Boston. And I went into this room with this very pretty girl, and that helped. And I remember that they had, they had some kind of eye exercises that you would do. They would teach you how to keep eye contact with people. And I decided, I would try to be the perfect candidate for not taking, not needing Scientology. And I remember one of the questions on the test. The test was studded with trick questions, sometimes double questions. And one of them was, one of those, when did you stop beating your wife questions? And the question was, would you beat a 10-year-old child, and if so, would you feel guilty? The answer would be no, I wouldn't, beat the child, and yes, I would feel guilty if I did. But I didn't know how to answer the question, and so I answered just yes. and there were a number of questions like that. But anyway, I tried to answer all the questions so that I would not need Scientology. And as it turned out, I desperately needed it, according to my score. And they convinced me that I was psychologically unstable enough that I should need the need their courses. So I just wanted to relay that bit of information of how they kind of coerce people into or convince
people. Yeah. Well, Peter, I appreciate that anecdote and thank you for it. A lot of people are asking about this film, The Master, which I assume you've seen.
Yes, I thought it was beautifully done. I understand the complaint about it being obscure, and perhaps because I'm so steeped in all this, it was especially meaningful for me. The characters, especially the L. Ron Hubbard figure that Philip Seymour Hoffman played, I thought it was, you know, wonderfully done. And I also Amy Adams as his wife. Her portrayal of, you know, the figure who would have been Mary Sue Hubbard in that paradigm. She was great and very persuasive.
Well, you're getting a lot of questions like this, too. Marianne writes, with a wide variety of topics he covers, how does Wright work? Can you give an example of a typical writing research day of project? I mean, we're talking about writing films as well, right?
Well, of course, research is key to my technique, whether it's films or plays or nonfiction books or articles. And so I spend a lot of time reporting. My reporting process is that, you know, I make a list of the obvious people to talk to, and I go talk to them. And then when I finish the interview, I say, who else should I talk to? And they'll give me a list of less obvious people, and I'll go talk to them and then ask the same question. And that way the roots go deeper and deeper into the soil. And when I finally have no more new names on the list, I know I've populated the universe that I'm exploring. And I try to talk to those people as much as possible. And with plays and stuff like that, I actually write note cards about scenes that I want to do, and then I lay them all out and try to arrange them into some kind of structure.
Well, it's been a pleasure having you with us. I thank you, and ongoing success to you. Congratulations on the new book and the play. And I've been talking with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, author, playwright, screenwriter Lawrence Wright this hour, and he's talking about the book Going Clear with Mark Danner tonight at 7 p.m. at Berkeley Repertory Theater. Forum was produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, engagement producer Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks, senior editor Dan Zoll, and executive producer Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.